Isn't that the question? If you really knew me, could you love me anyway? Well, hi, my name is Randy Wasink, and I'm one of the founders and co-leaders here at Keystone, and it is so great to be with you here again today. Brady is, he's suffering for Jesus up in Bray Harbor this weekend up there with his family leading the service. You know, somebody's got to do it, I guess, but there's a fear. There's a fear that lurks deep inside each one of us, a fear that if someone I cared about learns of my past mistakes or learns of my past actions or what I did or said in my unwise youth or learns how insecure I fear about my place in life, learns how different my worldview is than their worldview, or if they could hear the real thoughts going on inside of my head. If you knew the real me, and you took time to understand me, could you? Would you love me anyway? And if you knew everything about someone else, could you really love them anyway? My mother-in-law had this little saying on a box in her bathroom that I think was there since I was dating my wife in high school. And it said this, it said, a friend is someone who knows all about you and loves you just the same. I thought, man, that is really true. Because, you know, there's a dance that we dance in our relationships, and so much of it is unspoken. Am I on the inside or am I on the outside? Are we good? Or am I on the outs? Am I welcome or am I unwelcome? And it's how it seems to really work out in our personal relationships, and it works in our churches too. People walk into our doors or they view us online, and each inside each one of them, they carry scars and hurts and fears and doubts and regrets and baggage from bad decisions, and they begin to dance and they begin to interact with the church, and there's wondering if there's potential for a relationship here. How much can I share? Can I express my doubts? Can I ask my unresolved questions? And underlying all of that is this nagging question. If I do open up, if I do share, if I begin to get vulnerable and really ask the questions that I need to ask, would this church, would Keystone love me anyway? And if you do get to the point of walking through our front doors and you don't feel welcome, you quickly begin to believe that this church is not for you. So it all begins with this question: is the church really a welcoming place? Because if you can't navigate our website and you can't easily get a basic understanding of who we are and what we do, or if the images you see remind you of the church of your past, or remind you of why you were felt unwelcomed in your past encounter with church, you won't even walk through our door. And if you do get to the point of walking through the door and you don't feel welcome, you quickly begin to believe that this church is not for you. It's not for me. And you stand in the gathering space and you've got that, you know, that newcomer look. And if 15 or 20 of us walk by you without recognizing that look, the likelihood of you getting to the point of building an authentic relationship with Keystone, so you can ask the questions that you've been wrestling with, is unlikely. Instead, you're going to feel that this church is not for you, and you are an outsider. And it's easy to see why one might feel like an outsider. Churches develop their own language, their own attitudes, their own way of doing relationships. They have written rules. They have unwritten rules. They have icons. And our ability to understand them and to catch on to their meanings and to follow them determines whether we'll be welcomed on the inside or we'll be left on the outside. Because the gravitational pull of every church is toward the insiders. And over time, every church, if we're not careful, becomes a church for who? Church people. And there's a problem with that. The problem is what it communicates to church people and what it communicates to the rest of the world. And this is what it says. It says that church is for church people. Therefore, Christianity must be for church people too. And perhaps Jesus only came for church people also. But if we know intuitively, which I believe most of us do, that Christ didn't come just for church people, the insiders, who did he come for? Well, you remember this verse? For God so loved the world. It's going to be a world up here in just a minute. Yes! Probably one of the first verses you ever heard. God so loved the world. And to me, that means everybody. It doesn't say that God so loved the church people. It doesn't say, for God so loved the good people. For God so loved the people who could find the book of Ephesians as fast as Brady Nemers, or people who have the words to all the songs that we sing, or know where to check in their kids, or know where to park in the parking lot so they can be the first ones out to get to their favorite lunch place. It doesn't mention any of that, does it? It says, for God so loved the world. And I interpret that as everybody. And in the early days of Keystone, we were so concerned about turning inside that we put up all kinds of barriers to people transferring from other churches. I know it sounds mean, but we told people straight up, if you aren't actively engaged in the lives of your unchurched friends and neighbors, then you probably won't enjoy being here. This place will likely make you uncomfortable. And this church might not be for you. We even had this really non-church-looking band complete with ugly sweaters, guys with crazy long hair. We were playing in what looked like to be a shoebox in a cigar-smelling, beer-smelling Charlevoix Banquet Center. Church people didn't want to show up at anything that looked like that. And we had this crazy goofball sound guy who is, well, you might remember him as Brady Nemers. And that was me and Gene planning the service. In fact, I think those are our incorporation documents down there when we got Keystone started. And I'll tell you, they don't make laptops like that anymore. You should see that thing. I wish I still had it. Well, back then, neither Brady or I could imagine Keystone as it is today. And that we would separate for about 12 years and come back together again and serve as co-leaders. But looking back then, I suppose, yeah, we were a little young and we were a little cocky and idealistic. And sometimes we were perceived that way by some of the established churches. But frankly, we were scared. We were scared about the high potential, the natural trajectory of becoming exactly what we were asked to be a solution to. We were started by a group of churches with a mandate to be outsider welcoming, to be a church for people who don't like church. And I'm in no way saying that they were less than or bad, just that they had this, by their statement over the years, moved from being outside focused to being more and more inside focused. And that is a tough trajectory to reverse. So early on, we went out to discover how we could be a more welcoming place. We started doing focus groups. We talked to our unchurched and dechurched friends. We went door to door and we asked people what they found unwelcoming or undesirable or off-putting about church. As a result, absent are many of the religious icons, the passing of the offering plate, membership, unannounced standing up and sitting down, no awkwardly turning to grab and harass the person next to you with a fake unwelcome greeting. Avoiding churchy terms like we use gathering space instead of narthex. Or if we need to use a churchy word, we explain it. We just don't toss it out there to see if people get it. And we prioritized creating an open, beautiful space, attractive facility with a welcoming smell of popcorn. Oh, he had to bring it up. It will come back. Trust us, it will come back. Local coffee, cappuccino, signage to help you navigate, even a special check-in desk for new families, a well-known top 40 opener like the one we did from Pink this morning, designed to make a connection point to something familiar so that their church experience won't start out feeling so foreign. Guest experience teams that are really, genuinely happy to be here and love you guys and serve coffee with a smile. And we learned over time through trial and through a lot of error. And yes, we did make some mistakes along the way, but it's how we learn and grow. I recently tried, and keyword being tried, to create a welcoming environment for a group of Keystone people who were embarking on a really cool high adventure. I was leading the Keystone High Adventure Group adventure trip to Alaska, and I prepared a welcome plan for them that would help them inform them of our backpacking team, of our agenda and our activities and how we would best prepare for a week of flight seeing and whale watching and hiking and crossing a glacier and other things that one might run into and encounter in the wilds of Alaska. And one of those things was to teach people how to properly use bear spray. Now, since we don't use this very much in Michigan, most of us aren't used to carrying it, let alone even using it. So I got each person a brand new can of this bear spray, and I got them some expired cans that we could test them out on so they could practice using it. Because face-to-face with a grizzly is not the best time to figure out how to use your bear spray. So being the good, welcoming, planning host that I am, part of my orientation was to demonstrate proper use of said bear spray. So I gave a quick overview of where to carry it, and you know, it's got this really handy little case and this thing here that you can put your belt through so you can reach it, or better yet, on your backpack right here, because you never know when you're going to come around the corner. Taught people how to remove this handy glow-in-the-dark safety thing, because one hates when it goes off when you bump it and you're standing next to it. And then how to point it and how to aim it and how to discharge it and all of that. So just to make sure I wouldn't spray anybody, I turned around, I flipped it off, and I unleashed a 1 second burst of bear spray. And after a few seconds, our whole world changed. And one of them caught the ending of it on video.
Hey, Randy, what just happened?
Would have been better with sound up front. I'll tell you. In fact, do you want to experience it yourself? I'm just thinking I could just pull this off and... So all 12 of us learned pretty quickly how to pay attention to the wind. And it was so funny that while we were laughing, the more you laughed, the more of it you'd suck in, the more your lungs would burn, and you'd look at each other all buckled over, and they're laughing, and they're choking, and everything's burning. And, well, it wasn't the best welcome to Alaska. Now, if I did try it in here, you'll be glad that this room changes out its air every 10 minutes. I'll tell you that. The key is, though, that we try. We try to be welcome. We try new things. We try to find ways to make people accepted. And we do our best. And if we fail, we just adapt and overcome. And unfortunately, I will never live that event down because our eyes and nose and throats and mouths are burning for a long, long, long time. Now, the tendency is for a church is that we continue to drift toward the insiders. And instead of towards everybody, well, this thing can be managed. And unless we label it and we understand it and we put in counteractive measures, the inevitable is going to happen. We're going to turn inside. We're going to turn to what we know and what we're comfortable with. Because you and I, we feel safe with our insiders. And we'll no longer then be a truly welcoming place. Now, the good news is that we're not the first group of people to struggle with this. In fact, one of the most fascinating stories in the New Testament is one about the early church. and they encountered this very issue. See, what was happening is Paul and Barnabas were hanging out, and it was recorded for us in this book of Acts, and Acts is the activities that were put together by a lot of the early church leaders. Well, before I jump into Acts and go through that whole passage with you, I do need to make a confession. Brady is basing this series from the book of Ephesians, and so he wanted me to stay in Ephesians today. And specifically, he wanted me to teach from Ephesians 2, verses 11, 12, and following. And the passage talks about insiders and it talks about outsiders, but it starts this way. Therefore, remember that formerly you who are Gentiles by birth and called the uncircumcised by those who called themselves the circumcision, which is done in the body by human hands, remember that at the time you were separate from Christ, excluded from the citizenship in Israel, and foreigners to the covenants of the promise. And I read that, and where he wanted me to go, I was like, what? Dude, this is jammed full of all kinds of cultural meaning that it's going to take an hour for us to really process as a group. So, here's the deal. Don't tell them. This is our little secret, okay? I'm going to leave the teaching of that passage to him. And then after I read that, I thought, you know, I'm pretty simple-minded. Because the first thing I found myself wondering was, well, how did they know? How do you know that someone was an insider, that they were circumcised, or they were an uncircumcised outsider? When they met on the street, did they ask? Was there some special signal or greeting that somehow gave it away? Or when you went into church, did they first usher you into a little side room and do an audit? Is that how the TSA got started? I don't know. But now you're wondering too. Anyway, I decided to go back to one of the first recorded meetings of the early church because it both set the tone and it gave the church its marching orders. See, they were drifting away from the insiders and the tensions were developing inside the church. Who is this church really for? They argued about. Is it just for the Jews, or is it for the Gentiles too, meaning the non-Jews, meaning most of us? And the pastors and church leaders of the day were teaching the Christ followers that unless you are circumcised and follow the customs taught by Moses in the Jewish law, you cannot have a relationship with God. And this caught the ears of Paul and Barnabas. And according to verse 2, it brought Paul and Barnabas into sharp dispute. And so Paul and Barnabas began a debate with them. And to end the debate, because it just wouldn't stop and they weren't coming together, they all decided it was best to send some representatives of both views to Jerusalem to see the apostles and to see the elders about this question. So when they arrived in Jerusalem, the meeting began and the views were all shared. And when Paul and Barnabas were invited to speak, they started by telling stories about the unbelievable things that God was doing among the Gentiles through them. That God was active and involved in the lives of the Gentiles? The pagans? What? Even the pagan Gentiles? And Paul said, yes. Then Peter, St. Peter, stands and he takes the floor. And he says this. He says, friends, you know well that from early on, God made it quite plain that he wanted the pagans. Now, if you ever wanted to make somebody feel welcome in church, just welcome them as a pagan. Hey, pagan, good to see you. Maybe not. He made it quite plain that he wanted the pagans to hear the message of this good news and embrace it. And not in any secondhand or roundabout way, but firsthand, straight from my mouth. And God, who can't be fooled by any pretense on our part, but always knows a person's thoughts, gave them the Holy Spirit exactly as he gave him to us. He treated the outsiders exactly as he treated us, beginning at the very center of who they were and working from that center outward, cleaning up their lives as they trusted and believed in him. Let's keep it here just a sec. Isn't that a beautiful picture of how God works in our lives? From the center outward, cleaning up our lives as we grow in our trust and belief for him. Let's go on. He says, so, why are you now trying to out-God God? Loading these new believers down with rules that crushed our ancestors and crushed us too? Don't we believe that we are saved because the Master Jesus, amazingly and out of sheer generosity, moved to save us just as he did those from beyond our nation? So what are we arguing about? And there was dead silence. And no one said a word. And when the room was quiet, Barnabas and Paul reported matter-of-factly on the miracles and wonders God had done among the other nations through their ministry. The silence deepened, and you could hear a pin drop. Then James broke the silence. It is my judgment, therefore, that we should not make it difficult for the Gentiles who are turning to God. In other words, if there is anything in our church that's a stumbling block for people who are turning to God, we need to get rid of it. What James is saying is this. It's okay if people choose to reject the forgiveness offered by Jesus on the cross. That's their decision to do. But let's don't put a whole lot of other things in their way to cause them to get confused before they get to the real issue, which is the cross. And so James is saying, Keystone, let's make it our mission to not make it difficult. Another way of saying it is this. Let's do everything we can to make it easy for those who are turning to God. And this was so important to them that they documented it in a statement and they assigned people to go out in pairs to deliver that document to each one of the local churches and all the churches that have been planted in the region. Because they knew the church will always gravitate toward insiders and the church will always make it difficult for people who are turning to God. And one of the most important things you and I can do is every once in a while sit down and ask the question, as we do with our staff and with our board, what are we doing that's making it difficult for people to turn to God? Because we unintentionally or sometimes even intentionally set up hurdles, language, money, lineage, color, race, political affiliation, Ford versus Chevy, all kinds of undocumented things that make it difficult. And this cannot be. We can't allow this to happen. And if you guys experience this, you need to let us know. Why? Because our big idea today is there are no outsiders when it comes to the love of God. And Keystone believes that the good news of Jesus Christ is for everybody, don't we? Listen, this is the good news. And everybody is invited, that everybody gets in the same way, and everybody can meet the requirements. Everybody is invited, which means we need to have all the rungs on the ladder. But now I need to bring it closer to home, make it a little more personal. See, Keystone is made up of a bunch of individuals. And together, we make up Keystone. It's a coming together, this room is, of a bunch of individuals with all of our pluses and with all of our minuses. And when people experience our church, they are experiencing all of you. And when people experience you, they're experiencing a piece of our church. And if that's the case, we need to start right here, at home, in our own heart. Our hearts have been under siege for quite some time. but especially for the past 6 months. We only have to look at our interactions on social media to see how we are encouraged to polarize instead of seeking genuine understanding. People are increasingly interpreting the actions of others in the least generous way possible. And they're assuming the worst of intentions. We're creating this call-out culture in which almost anything one says and does can result in public shaming. And if there are no outsiders when it comes to the love of God, then everyone is welcome at church. And if the church is made up of individuals who are being drawn into an environment of sizing up and shaming instead of thoughtful understanding and dialogue, what is the church going to look like in a few years? Who's going to come in and ask an honest question, share a doubt, dare to express their understanding of an issue? Who would dare to share how a bad decision train wrecked their lives in order that they could finally start taking some healing, growing, and reconciling steps? I'm worried. A few years ago, I went to a conference. And we talked about something at that conference called a moral circle. And everyone has a moral circle. And that's often made up of family and people who are central to our lives, who are close to us, who we're comfortable with. And our churches do the exact same thing. You can just replace that me with a church. Our moral circle is the group we're comfortable with, and this is the one we are nicest towards. We show this group the most grace. And at that conference, they showed a video that really brought the point home to me. It was a convicting video to me, and I used it in a talk 4 years ago, so if you were here, I'm sorry. But I got a lot of calls afterwards because it was so impactful. And I would give anything, if you left this message with anything, that you would leave it with this video in mind. Let's watch it.
Let's just say this is you. You're the big red person. All these people around you are just the people that you come in contact with. Some are people that you're friends with. Some are just, you know, the checkout person at the grocery store. Everyone has a moral circle. And all that means is that the people that are most central to you there are going to get your most love, and they're the people that you're going to be nicest towards. Okay, how many of you here have waited tables? So you guys know what misery that is. I have waited tables also. Imagine a friend, a family member, somebody you really care about is going to start waiting tables. They go through the whole training process. You get a group of people together. You go, you sit in their section. You're all excited first night. And they come over, and they are just sweating bullets. Right? What do you say to them? Oh, don't worry about us. Don't worry about us. Don't even worry about us. We don't even need drinks. I don't even like water. It's fine. We're fine. I don't even like this. An hour later, they come over and take your order. You ordered steak. In front of you is cod. It's great. You love cod. Cod's terrific. We're going to eat this. This is going to be great. And then what do you do at the end of the night? You over-tip them, don't you? You over-tip them. Now, imagine that same scenario, and you have no idea who this server is. And they come, and you know what? You ordered Coke Zero, and this tastes like Diet Coke. So you stop making eye contact with these people. You start to do that mental math of the tip going down, down, down. I'm not going to even look at this person. You know, this is ridiculous. We were paying for a good time. What is this? Two different types of behavior from us for two different people. One is your mom. One is your friend. One is your brother. The other one isn't. But the other one's somebody's mom. The other one's somebody's friend. The other one's somebody's brother. Why do we justify two different types of behavior for people that we come in contact with? We show kindness to our kind, meaning the people that are inside that circle are generally going to be people that you think are your kind. Ethnicity, background, financial status, age, orientation, family member, skill set, you name it. These are the people that I am going to give my most love to. Just imagine with me, how different would your world be if you just expanded your moral circle? What if all of a sudden the people in your church were known for treating other people in their society like family? What would that do to you? What would that do to your church? What would that do to your life and your heart?
How different would it be if you expanded your moral circle? And if our church worked intentionally to expand our moral circle? You know who's on your inside, right? But who have you kept on your outside? What group of people have you moved out of your moral circle or decided not to let into your moral circle to show grace to or kindness to? If Keystone is to live out its purpose of helping people, not just the insiders, of helping all people find and follow Jesus, and Keystone is made up of each one of you and me, we have some work to do, don't we? It seems like we need to intentionally evaluate and expand our moral circles as individuals and as a church. And fortunately for us, Jesus was an absolute master at this. So I want to wrap up today by looking how Jesus did this. We're going to look together at a section of the Bible in the book of Matthew, and that's the first book of the New Testament. But I want to give you a little context first. The religious establishment in the day, and they're called the Pharisees, sought after something called purity. And to do that, they just pulled away from the messy stuff. And anything that was broken or messy, they just kept at a distance. And they were very, very clear between what's on the inside and what's on the outside. They had a very clear line. And one of the things they and most everybody viewed as the scum of the earth was tax collectors. Kind of like we do today, I guess, but they were seen as selfish thieves and they had no regard for others, the tax collector. And as in this encounter, we're going to see how Jesus chose a different path. And in seeking a relationship, he moves towards the perceived outsider named Matthew. So let's read this together. Passing along, Jesus saw a man at work collecting taxes, and his name was Matthew. And Jesus says, "Come along with me." And Matthew stood up and followed him. Later, when Jesus was eating supper at Matthew's house with his close followers, a lot of disreputable characters came and joined them. When the Pharisees saw him keeping this kind of company, they had a fit and they lit into Jesus' followers. What kind of example is this from your teacher? Acting cozy with crooks and riffraff. And I love how the Message translation puts this. Jesus, overhearing, shot back. Who needs a doctor? The healthy or the sick? Go figure out what this means. I'm after mercy, not religion. I am here not to coddle the insiders. It seems like that Jesus sees that there's just two types of people. Those who are connected with God and those who are not connected with God. And it seems very clear to me where he puts the priority. The insiders often avoid relationship with outsiders if the rules aren't followed. And Jesus demonstrated that it's less about the rules and it's more about the relationship. It all begins with relationship. Relationship before rules. And he's looking to us to help people find their way back to God. And isn't that the purpose of Keystone? To help people find and follow Jesus? So here's something I want you to really ponder about. If being opposed to what someone is doing is keeping you from engaging with them, then you have a higher standard than Jesus. Who is God desiring to reach through you? Who has God put directly in your path, in your life? Who are you withholding the love of Jesus from? Who are you keeping outside of your moral circle? We need the church to be the safest place on the planet for people to engage conversations of doubt, faith, and differences in belief. We need to put conversation above policies. We need to make a difference instead of just making a point. And if I'm disgusted with somebody and I represent the church and they perceive that the church is disgusted with them, then it's not a big leap for them to feel that God is disgusted with them also. And if you're one that's bailed from church or from God because you felt unwelcome, I'm sorry. The problem begins with Christ followers like me, who forgot how offensive we were to God until we realized that we could not bridge the gap between our brokenness and imperfection and God's perfection. And until we accepted the forgiveness and reconciliation that a relationship with Jesus Christ offers. Theology should never get in the way of loving people. Why is this important? Remember our big idea today. There are no outsiders when it comes to the love of God. We've been leaving you with some questions every week to talk on your drive home or while you have lunch. And here's a few of them to consider, and there's a number of more questions in the Big Idea Guide, which you can download online. How have religious organizations put hurdles in the way of God's love? And have you intentionally or unintentionally adopted any of these hurdles in your life? Is the statement, theology should never get in the way of loving people, convicting or liberating to you? And how would this change some specific relationships in your life? Keystone friends, let's be a church that takes down the hurdles. Because Christ came for everybody. Because Christianity is for everybody. And we believe the church should be for everybody as well. We must live what James says. Let's make a pact that you and I will not make it difficult for those who are turning to God. And let's challenge each other to do the same. Let's pray. Father, if it's appropriate, remind us of the times where we have felt unwelcoming and unwelcomed. We've been in that situation where we were just on the outside looking in, and how painful and how horrible and how lonely that felt. And in doing so, then give us the courage to not put others through that. To look at our own moral circle, to look at our friends and relationships, and see where you would like us to expand. Just one person at a time. Thank you for a place here that although we're not perfect, we are striving. We are striving every day as board, as staff, as leaders, as volunteers, and hopefully all of us in our lives to be a more welcoming person, a more open-minded person, a more welcoming place, a more open-minded place. A place that greets people with arms wide open. And instead of sizing them up and judging them and excluding and tossing them out, we put our arms around them and say, you are a loved child of God and you're welcome here. It's our prayer. Give us the courage to be people like that. In Jesus' name, amen. Hey, thanks a lot for coming to Keystone. Pray for Brady as he's suffering up north, and we'll see you back next week.